With your permission, we'd like to talk shop for just a moment.
Because we've got a good racket going, you're not going to be able to touch our own.
Oh, okay, so you've got a racket going.
Cookies are not the only food. I tell that to my children all the time.
It's time for the Publisher Podcast. It's time for the Publisher Podcast.
Here's a man that really appreciates that new England pound.
Hi, how's it going, and welcome to the Video Week podcast. My name is Vincent Flood. I'm the editor-in-chief at Video Week, and Laurie Good is my guest this week. Laurie is the chief marketing officer at Index Exchange. If you don't know Index, one of the industry's leading ad tech companies. Laurie's also one of those people who radiates positivity and calm, and I think she's also one of the industry's finest marketers. One of those marketers who isn't just invested in her own company's message, but somebody who takes a deep interest in what's happening across the industry and the future of the industry. We get into everything from Index's own marketing strategy, the challenges Laurie faced when she came in. We talk about the state of the European media market, Index Exchange's commitment to focusing on the sell side, something that not so many companies are doing these days. We talk about margin compression in ad tech, TV's cost versus effectiveness, and how the mid to long tail of CTV is faring, and we get into various other topics. A few things from us first. We've got the video and TV advertising buyer's guide coming up. This will be a new guide aimed at media buyers, brands, agencies typically. We want to create something like an industry bible for omnichannel video buying. You know, so everybody has gaps in their knowledge, and the idea is to try and bring together a guide that helps supplement and hopefully fill those gaps for buyers. We'll be looking at CTV, online publishing, digital out of home, gaming, social. We want to look at the full spectrum of media sources. If your company would like to feature that guide, you can get in touch via the Video Week website. Then on the event side of things, we've got New Video Frontiers coming back in April. It goes from the 15th to 16th next year. We'll be doing 2 days at King's Place in London, and it's going to be bigger and better than anything we've done before. So if you're traveling from abroad, you might want to book those flights, or if you'd like to get in touch with us via the Video Week or the New Video Frontiers website if you'd like to partner. Now, I'll cross over to my conversation with Laurie, and I hope you enjoy. So, Laurie, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Delighted to have you here. We kick things off by asking people how they found themselves in the role they're in. I don't think many of us set out to be ad tech CMOs. I think it's something that we arrive at by accident. So, yeah, what was your journey to get there?
Accidental, in one word. I have somewhat of a circuitous journey. I thought that I would be an English professor or teacher of some sort. I majored in English education and journalism in college. And then I found myself in the restaurant industry right after college for 5 years. I was a restaurant manager, managing everything from front of the house operations to wine list and liquor list, bar menu, all of that good training. I dabbled a little bit in marketing. Then I ended up at an ad agency a few years after that, somewhat accidentally, and in ad operations specifically. And so I learned all about trafficking digital ads in the early days. This is just over 20 years ago, and really fell in love in understanding all of the intricacies of the technology and trafficking. And then, of course, all of the ad measurement, the delivery systems led to measurement and really understanding ad measurement. I moved into ad serving after that and was a technical account manager with Atlas, which was a third-party ad server back in the day. And that was at Microsoft. We were acquired by Microsoft then. I moved into sales role and then eventually moved into product marketing. And that's where I sort of found my love and home of really understanding product value, understanding customer needs, translating that back to them in terms of value proposition and messaging. And so I was at Microsoft for a number of years, We sold Atlas to Facebook at the time. This was 2013. And we rebuilt Atlas from the ground up as part of Facebook. That was a really exciting time. And I really managed everything from product marketing to all of the marketing in the brand, content, everything else. So I was kind of a one-woman show, both at Microsoft and Facebook. And then I moved over to Amazon. And I ended up leading all of the marketing and training global organization for the ads business. And I was there for 5 years, kind of building that out. And obviously, it's such a behemoth today. And then I joined Index. So really similar type of role to the Amazon role in leading global marketing and training. But of course, at a smaller company that's really focused in ad tech as a sell side platform. And so that's kind of how I ended up at CMO. But from a functional standpoint, a lot of what I do is very similar to what I did at Amazon in that I lead marketing here. I'm also responsible for learning and development for the company. And then I've stepped into executive lead for sustainability and for our diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging efforts.
A lot going on there.
So many things.
That's really interesting about the ad ops that you started your career in ad ops because, yeah, it was something that I was exposed to early on. And I've always thought that it's something that people really should have some exposure to. For me, it was about seeing how clunky it was even to get the most simple campaign live. And I think once I understood that, the inevitability of automating this process just seemed really obvious to me that why programmatic would work, I think.
Right.
It was just, huge amount of work going into getting the most sort of a small amount of budget away for a publisher. I'm always interested in, I suppose at Video Week, we've been at the receiving end of so many different ad tech marketing strategies over the years. And as a result, I take an interest in the different strategies that, different companies use. What have been the main marketing challenges for you at Index?
So I've been at Index for just over 5 years now. And I would say that the challenges have been different at different stages, which makes it actually a really fun job to have. When I first joined Index, we had different branding. We were positioning ourselves slightly differently in the industry. And the first kind of order of business for me was really recognizing through the interview process that the way that Index demonstrated and communicated who they were, their identity outwardly, did not seem to match who I met at Index. And I feel like there was some outdated aspects of what our mission was and what the company really strived for in the industry just really didn't match up with who I met and how they talked about Index and the feeling that I got. And so the first order of business, I updated all of the branding for Index that I think better reflects how Index shows up in market as core to who we are as a company. And so that was kind of number one. The second big challenge that I faced was that we had just rebuilt our architecture from the ground up, which is a really exciting time. But it also meant that we were now opening up new channels. So streaming TV is an example. We had not focused on that before, but in rebuilding the exchange, that opened up the channel for us to scale that much faster and to come to market quicker. So we really focused on then repositioning ourselves as a company, as a video company, video first, or offering the streaming TV capabilities that we previously did not have. Index was very much known for web-based advertising. And so that was kind of the second challenge. And then I think the challenge that I'm going through now, we've done the repositioning. We have really started to differentiate Index in market. And I think that's something that when I first started was a challenge for Index is okay, the SSP landscape is somewhat crowded. And a lot of the SSPs had similar capabilities, similar supply. What really differentiated Index from another company? And so that's something that, as the years, the past few years have emerged, there have been opportunities for us to truly differentiate in our policies, in the way that we approach industry news that's happening, and how we react to that and really allow those as opportunities to better state our position in market and how that's different. So that's been really exciting. Where we are now, and I would say this from the past couple of years, is that Index is not a public company and we do not take outside investment. And what that means is that we can look at the public companies that are primary competitors at their earnings calls. And we understand then, you know, okay, what is the size of their sales and marketing efforts? You know, how much resource do they have? And what I know for sure is that our resources are much, much smaller than that of our competitors or others in the market. And so you have to approach marketing differently for a company that is compared to or trying to stand up against companies who have more resources. And the way that you do that, again, is really trying to find the white space and figuring out, okay, you know, what, why and how is Index different? Where do we need to show up differently? And how do we leverage kind of earned opportunities or ways that, you know, we're not necessarily throwing money in an issue. So, you know, money at the problem. So we're going to have to figure out how do we best leverage the resources we have and use those creatively in different ways that allow us to stand apart from what everybody else is doing. And so that's been kind of the primary marketing challenge, I would say now, is that I have to make do with less. And so I think that we've done a really good job at punching above our weight as a company, and specifically within marketing. I'm super proud of the work that the team does to make sure that we have a point of view, that we're showing up consistently, and that we are visible in market in a world where we just have less, I think, than other folks do in terms of resources.
In all honesty, it would have barely occurred to me that you have significantly less than your competitors. So you are seemingly doing a great job of managing what you do have. I mean, as you said, you know, you guys have, you know, whether it's Andrew speaking on stage or other people from Index, you've quite clearly stated positions in the market on various things from Google to the open web. And, you know, I would never regard Index as a company that shies away from the difficult conversations. I think probably being private probably helps on that front.
Yeah.
But I do notice at the same time, though, there's people with, you know, maybe less resources, who, you know, particularly on LinkedIn, they're sort of going into attack mode. I think there's maybe a belief that there's no such thing as bad publicity. And, you know, it seems to have gotten even worse, I think, since people stopped using X for industry debate, where maybe there was a, you know, it's a bit more permissible, rightly or wrongly, to be quite, you know, adversarial on X. But yeah, I'm curious about, but, you know, I haven't really noticed Index getting involved in that. I mean, I'm curious, you know, is that a culture thing? Is it a policy thing? Or, yeah, how come you're not, you know, Index aren't out sort of swinging punches at competitors on LinkedIn?
It is. I've noticed the same thing, Vinny, and I would say I'm just disappointed lately. I have also observed that rhetoric on LinkedIn or in blogs or other types of articles just seems to be more unproductive, if you will. You know, there. I think that it is important as an industry to have really difficult conversations and to take opposing viewpoints when necessary, you know, as needed. But there's a difference between stating your opinion and having a difficult conversation or having an opposing viewpoint and turning that into something that becomes a little bit more personal, whether that feels like an attack on a human or, you know, on a company at large. And it feels like we are starting to slide into a mode as an industry where that is just becoming more rampant. And like, frankly, I just feel disappointed. You know, I'm just disappointed in that kind of behavior. I think from an industry perspective, you know, ad tech has never had the best reputation across the entire advertising industry. And I feel as an industry that we've worked really hard over the past few years to come into our own and to mature and to demonstrate that we are adding value broadly to the advertising ecosystem. And this kind of rhetoric from ad tech on public forums like social media, LinkedIn, doesn't help that cause. You know, I think it sort of regresses ad tech back into this, you know, shadier corner that we were in years ago. From an Index perspective, we do have policies written, but we've never enforced them, if that makes sense. It is very cultural at Index that we would not, you know, participate in personal attacks and things like that. I think that we are, you know, I'm going to make a big generalization here, but, you know, we're Canadian based. I think that, like, the founder of the company, the, you know, a lot of our executive leaders, like, we, you know, the kind of known as the, like, the nice people, you know, quote, I'm doing air quotes here. But we're just not going to stoop to a level of personal attack. And I think it's a reactive position to be in. It's, you know, I think, you know, people tend to go into personal attack when there's fear underlying or panic about something. You know, there's something kind of underlying going on that drives that type of behavior. But honestly, you know, I'm reading some of these things and I just want to say, okay, everyone, recess is over, you know, come off the playground and sit back at your desk and get your work done, because it's not productive. And so, you know, culturally, you know, Andrew certainly sets a tone. Andrew Casale, our CEO and founder, sets a tone, but, you know, we won't, you know, step into that foray as a company, even while we might have opposing positions about, you know, what the best thing to do is moving forward as an industry, or we might, you know, disagree with policies certain companies have, but we're not going to get into an area where we feel like it's productive or helpful or kind or, you know, collaborative to call people out in a way that is harmful.
Yeah, it is interesting. I've wondered what the root cause, you know, is it a kind of, it's maybe a little bit more desperation in the mm-hmm. air at the moment. You know, people are under pressure. Equally, I do wonder if it's just a deliberate marketing tactic, and you know, I think there's a new breed of PR agency that is advising people to, you know, go ahead and rattle a few cages. And I think you can see, you know, as with any social media, you can garner huge attention by, you know, being extreme in your views. But I think a lot of time what that doesn't factor in is the amount of people that it turns off, or the people who don't want to acquire mm-hmm. that company because they imagine you're difficult to work with or anything else as well. I feel like those negative externalities don't show up in the sort of social metrics that people mm-hmm. see.
Yeah, it's so much like, for me, it's very much about, so I agree. I think there is a lot of pressure in our industry and for certain companies now to demonstrate revenue gain and value and everything else. But I think it's such a character tell in the way that you react to things when you're under pressure. You know, you have choices that you can make. So you can't necessarily control what happens to you, but you control how you react to what happens to you. So I think on that one side, I find it hard to come up with a good excuse for that behavior. And then on the other one, on the marketing tactic side, I definitely can see where some companies might take the tact of, and for the same reason that I want to differentiate Index and stand apart from what everyone else is doing. But again, you just have a choice to make. And reputation to me, brand reputation, trust building is so important in our industry. And I'm not sure how you build trust legitimately in that area as a brand, as a person, and as the legacy that you leave behind. It's a deliberate decision that everyone can have at every turn, or, you know, every instance. And, you know, you choose to turn right or left. And it's, you know, surprising to me, I think, the consistent left turning. I'm not sure. Again, the unproductive is like the best word I can come up with it for, is like, I just don't know what you gain when you turn left for anyone. And, you know, broadly for the industry, I think it just doesn't help. It's not helpful.
So again, going back to Index's clearly stated positions, mm-hmm. one of them is that you're firmly wedded to the sell side. This was something that I spoke with Andrew about on the podcast, and I suppose everyone who wants to go back and listen to that, it's a great example of, you know, not being shying away from difficult conversations. And Andrew gave a very impassioned reply, which I loved, about, you know, what an SSP actually does, you know, mm-hmm. all the different things that people don't understand what they do. It reminded me very much of when people say, you know, they sort of imagine event organizing as being, well, you just book a venue and get a few speakers. And it's like a red rag to a bull when we've all spent, you know, 60-hour weeks in the run-up to it. But I'm curious, just, you know, there obviously is, well, it's from the outside, you might say that there is pressure to work both sides, you know. A lot of companies have mm-hmm. built technologies for both advertisers and agencies and for publishers. And then, you know, companies like the Trade Desk have, you know, building things like OpenPath and going direct to supply. But I'm curious, like, is there stress on Index's position in this area? And, you know, how do you engage with the buy side when you do?
So I think it's very clear to Index where we stand and have always stood. And, you know, we have seen, you know, Google's antitrust trial is there for a reason. You know, we have seen where companies hold both the buy and the sell sides, and they're playing both sides of the fence. And in those instances, it's unclear who they're serving from a customer perspective versus, you know, is it benefiting Google, for example, and how they operate against both sides. The best sort of comparison that I think about is, you know, if I am buying a house, I have an agent that represents my interests, and they work with the seller who, you know, is representing the seller's interest. So the selling agent tries to get the maximum price and the convenient terms for their seller. My agent hopefully is trying to drive that price down and get terms that are convenient for me. If I used an agent that was on both sides, I don't know who's going to be happier. You know, if the buyer is going to be happier, the seller, because there's some compromise ostensibly in the middle. And the party that makes the most money out of that is the single consolidated agent, right? Because they're getting that money from both sides in a consolidated way. And so it is really important to us that we maintain buying through a DSP, because we believe that we will best serve the sell side when we're obsessed with figuring out the tools, the technology, the service layer to help publishers maximize their yield, maintain high quality inventory, and, you know, and have the DSP really focus on buyer capabilities that help them buy more seamlessly and really benefit them. This is not to say that Index doesn't also benefit buyers. You know, transparent and trustworthy supply really drives better performance, and we know that, and it drives real campaign value. And the focus that we have is, I think, a key differentiator, because it builds trust and efficiency across the ecosystem and how we're focused. And so while we invest in products that are also used by the buy side, like our marketplaces offering, we don't operate a DSP, and we have no intention to. We also support, you know, buy side clients with dedicated agency sales. That team is growing, and account management teams. And we ensure that, you know, demand is only as good as the supply, and supply is only as good as the demand. So we're really working on the buy side, the demand side, to ensure that they can find the supply that we represent well, while getting service that they need without conflict of interest. And, you know, in that way, we maintain quality and integrity of the publishers that we work with.
Yeah, I find it very hard to sort of come up with, you know, any sort of counter argument to that. I suppose one of the things that maybe I question is, you know, if a publisher has a floor price, and they're kind of setting the price, then perhaps, you know, does it make any difference who's bidding, you know, assuming. But yeah, as you just said there, and as Andrew said before, there's just so many different things that you need to factor in for servicing publisher, the different formats, mm-hmm. the different needs every day, that if you're not truly on board with, my job is to make this person more money.
Yes.
I could see how you can get distracted. I'm curious, how is the, what are you guys seeing in the European market, and which of the, you know, European countries are you most focused on? I'm also keen to talk about different channels, but yeah, in Europe, where are you guys sort of seeing the most opportunity at the moment?
Yeah, we are seeing huge opportunity in Europe. And even over the past couple of years, you know, we've invested in hiring new senior leadership in EMEA to focus on those markets. So I think you know well Katie Jones and John Tigg, and that's been really exciting. We have new country leads in some of the markets, and you know, we've really tried to tailor our products to the region's complexities, you know, which is really around legislation, as we all know, language and currency. And right now we're seeing really great growth. Germany is sort of a standout market for us currently, that represents really exciting opportunity for Index specifically. But we've been focused on the UK, France, Germany, Spain, and Italy primarily as focus markets in Europe. And you know, we've seen a lot of demand leaning towards supply through Index because of our global exchange quality policies. So we really have a focus on our exchange quality team and our policies that removed resellers, for example, so buyers know that Index is a direct path to high quality inventory. And you know, publishers are now focused on these trusted partnerships rather than sheer scale. And we're seeing them engage more closely than ever with our European teams, which is really great. I think the other challenge in Europe, of course, is around identity and privacy. And, you know, those have been around for a few years, but they remain, you know, challenges for both buyers and publishers. And so I think helping publishers kind of navigate consent frameworks and first-party data activation while they're protecting revenue is really important. And, you know, I think, you know, you reference channels, but if I think about, you know, streaming TV, I think, you know, that those challenges are relevant for streaming also, where targeting and optimization can be more complex. And, you know, we've seen great growth in streaming TV, particularly in the UK this year. So I think ultimately European open web publishers have seen impact in supply volume. You know, we're seeing the rise of course, generative AI and AI answers in search. And so we've been really working with pubs on supporting them with additional monetization opportunities, like adopting marketplaces where publishers can extend, you know, first-party audience data across other quality sites and things like that. But Europe is such a huge opportunity across different types of channels, even this, you know, despite these key challenges that are going on, which kind of happen everywhere, there's a lot of goodness going on in those markets.
Yeah, it is frightening. The drop in search traffic for publishers. I mean, you're hearing anywhere from 30 to 70%, depending on the nature of the publication. And a lot of the smaller publications strictly hit, but also even the very biggest are really struggling. I mean, there's a small part of me that hopes that, you know, the most premium publishers left standing might, you know, benefit by, you know, if more of the more long tail. I'm imagining like borderline MFA stuff.
Right.
If that going away, I would not lose huge amount of sleep. But
yeah,
it's just deeply concerning for democracies if all these. You know, journalists, we've seen newsrooms slashed for so long, and influencers are not plugging in that gap with, you know, just opinion-based content. So, yeah, it's very worrying. So one of the things that Andrew said recently, I think he said it was at ATS, he said about how the future of ad tech is that it's going to become a boring, low-margin business. I think something's probably said before, but he definitely said at ATS. I was watching a great video of an interview he did with Lara O'Reilly. And I'm curious about why, his or Index's thinking around, you know, the future of ad tech becoming this slightly more boring business.
Oh my gosh. So, Vinny, I have to tell you that after that conversation, this is like a window into my relationship with Andrew, maybe, but you know, we were out to drinks or something, I think. And I said, look, I need to give you some feedback because I know what he's saying and he's right. But the one part that I had a beef with is the boring part. And so you can, you know, kind of going back to our controversial statements thing, you know, when he characterizes our future as boring, I challenge him to ask any one of the engineers working on the index business whether they think what we're doing is boring, because I would actually say this is like the most exciting possible part of what we do, and anyone at this company would argue that it's not boring. And so, like, over half of our company is made up of engineers. And they come to Index because it is so freaking exciting to work on the scale of problem, the scale of internet that we work on. To give you an example, we process 2 petabytes of data every single day. And that, to put that into context, it is like you're streaming Netflix in HD for 80 years nonstop. That's what we process every single day. We have over 600 billion transactions that we're processing daily. For context, Visa has 600 million that they process every single day. So the sheer scale of what we do is insane. And I would say that most people who join Index are like, that is the coolest thing ever. It is so not boring. What he means by us becoming a boring, low margin business, though, if I draw that parallel back to finance, is that, you know, nobody thinks about the cost of a Visa transaction when they make their purchase, right? You're not like, oh gosh, that one, you know, that percentage point is going to Visa. I'm losing that money. They're thinking about the convenience, the infrastructure works, the transaction is being managed seamlessly and safely at broad scale, and it happens instantaneously. And so there are very, very complex things that are happening under the surface that an average consumer doesn't have to think about. So when we think about our own business and where we see the future going, we are the infrastructure. We are the pipes. We are solving all of those super, super complex issues that other companies, frankly, can't scale to. You know, we have the integrations, which was the hard work with 3,000 plus premium publishers globally, that was hard work. Maintaining those integrations is hard work. Processing everything in microseconds is hard work. And that's what the company is built to do. And so if you're thinking about like characterizing it, this was for Andrew, as boring, it's sort of like maybe if you are talking to someone who is trying to tout the kind of like the exciting sexiness of brand advertising and creators and the creative part of it. Okay, fine. But we're like the backbone of making the entire connected internet, streaming TV, mobile app, everything else work without anyone ever noticing. And it's insane scale that we process. And we do believe that as our infrastructure scales, as compute costs go down, and as we make our technology more and more efficient, our prices should also go down. Our take rate should go down. And so that's fundamentally a difference in I think, in how Andrew and our teams think about the future of our business, is we see it in the scale business and the volume business. You know, if Walmart's, you know, capabilities, I think Walmart's more of a US example, but I think that you all are familiar with Walmart in Europe, that, you know, their whole ecosystem of scale means that they can offer everyday low prices, you know? So that's kind of how we think about it, is the more we can scale, the more we can get really good at the infrastructure that we leverage to support the ecosystem, our prices ostensibly should go down because the volume is there to sustain our business, but we don't need to charge a massive take rate per transaction.
Yeah, it's and that was a great explanation, and I did guess at that. But
I know I'm like that's boring, Andrew.
I wasn't making trouble, but it's yeah. There's a lot to be said, I think, for it to be those, you know, dependable, low cost pipes. I feel like that. I felt, you know, doesn't sound as sexy as it, like you say, it is behind the scenes, but I think it's a a noble aspiration for where we should be going, and sort of enabling everyone else to make money, and for companies to make money in that way. I feel like we're on the right track. So what's, you know, there's obviously still huge amount of competition, particularly for CTV, and what's the index pitch for streamers and broadcasters?
There is quite a bit of competition. And I think, you know, index, I mentioned this a little bit earlier and when I was talking about marketing index, but we were a little bit later entrance into streaming TV and broadcasting. And I think the advantage for us is that we did build the exchange from the ground up. And so we had the opportunity to build the exchange in a way that would more seamlessly support streaming in a single platform, right? So it became a lot easier, I think, and simpler for people to buy with Index through streaming TV. We're focused, again, and we always will be across all of our supply on very premium, transparent, and fraud-free CTV supply. And we really want to ensure that when buyers are buying through Index, they can trust what they're buying. On the streaming and broadcasting front, there's, you know, unified access to programmatic demand. So we have, of course, buyers at scale across all markets. A lot of tools to maintain control, whether that's pacing, prioritization, you know, deal management. And we really focus on preserving broadcasters' user experience. So a lot of the innovation that we've done through structured ad podding, dynamic ad podding, all of that really helps with how the broadcasters' users experience streaming TV advertising. And we help streaming partners really through fewer intermediaries. And that helps preserve revenue, reduces data leakage. And I would say the last thing is that we take a really active role through bodies like the IAB Tech Lab to help set standards. So I think streaming is one of those areas that did not have the right standards in place and signaling in place to help streaming work as seamlessly as other more mature channels. And so that's something that we've taken a really active part in, helping to write and define, you know, OpenRTB signals, working through, right now we're working through the live event ad playbook or Leap to help with live event streaming signals. And so those are the kinds of things that I think we are taking an active role in helping the industry get better and move forward across the board. And therefore, I think are kind of at the forefront of making sure that streaming works well across across the industry.
Yeah, I'm curious about, you know, at this smaller end, the mid to long tail of CTV, I'm curious about how they're faring when it comes to programmatic trading. I mean, I hear very mixed results, with some doing very well, but there's often a salesperson ensuring that that programmatic campaign is delivered. And, you know, the agencies often will, you know, love to be able to activate programmatically, and, you know, but maybe they need a nudge. I've also then seen some others, often with maybe not the best content in the world, but maybe they've got, you know, a fast channel or maybe a fast app, and they have some, what in the online world would be very high quality content, and it is being shown on a TV screen. But for them, they see tumbleweed when they go programmatically. And I'm curious, you know, what you guys are seeing in terms of, you know, decisions that might come through, where the demand is going to, and, you know, what's the secret to success for, you know, a smaller player in the market making it work?
We saw a lot of this early on in the U.S. And a lot of streaming publishers begin to offer their supply programmatically at broader scale, and we're still seeing that. So even the U.S. has this concept of upfronts and upfront buying, and we're starting to see more and more large streamers put that kind of upfront inventory into programmatic environments. And so programmatic is really scaling in the US for streaming platforms, and it's offering access to varied types of demand. So you're getting really large brand advertisers, but we're also seeing a lot of smaller advertisers that have never been able to buy, you know, through streaming TV before, or TV generally before, now able to participate. And in Europe, we're starting to see a, you know, more of that kind of pickup as well, where there is strong demand across Europe for both guaranteed and non-guaranteed buying. And you know, index, from the index side, we support all. So we see a variety of buying methods being used depending on the market and the buyer. And I think success varies massively. The ones that are doing it well are the ones that are treating programmatic like a strategic revenue channel, and not a leftover one. So I can even think of, you know, an example being Channel 4, where I think historically they had been offering their inventory through, you know, a couple of DSPs, larger DSPs, but they've added some diversity to their DSPs as well. And I think added or onboarded, you know, StackAdapt and AdForm, which sort of, you know, offers this variety of advertiser that then can come in and buy programmatically. And so it sort of diversifies what they had limited before and brings more demand options, I think, in general, so that their inventory is sold through various channels at different, you know, kind of sizes of business that allows more advertisers to partake in, you know, the supply because it's there. And I think the ones that are really looking at programmatic as a revenue channel that's strategic and scaling are going to win longer term.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, I've seen this firsthand with, we see it with events and the growth of independent agencies. Mm. There were always a couple of, there's a big flagship indies who, you know, would often be on stage, New Video Frontiers, but there wouldn't even be that many in the audience. And every year you see more and more and more. And when you speak mm-hmm. to them, they all say, you know, maybe they had, you know, no CTV budget or TV budget a few years ago. They sort of started offering it maybe 200 grand the first year, a million the second year. And you realize that there's so many advertisers out there who TV didn't even occur to them as an mm-hmm. option, you know, or thinking they just, oh, that's just for, you know, Coke or, you know, the big global FMCGs and larger companies. And there hasn't been this culture of local TV advertising in quite the same way in the UK. Some bits have gone on, and AdSmart was a great forerunner in getting it started on the addressable mm-hmm. side of things. But I think there's still huge, yeah, it's great to be able to grow that pie, I think, by offering it out to, yeah, these small to mid-sized advertisers. And I really hope that all the broadcasters are rewarded for their investment too, as well as ad tech in getting it all going. Last time I saw you, which was not so long ago, was before the Future TV Advertising Conference, and you're on a panel there about cost versus effectiveness when it comes to TV, of course. I'm curious about what come out of that conversation, and yeah, were there any sort of firm conclusions? Did anyone win the debate, or was there, yeah?
I do think it being positioned as a debate was kind of a funny one to me, because it was called cost for the great debate, I think, cost versus effectiveness. And I think principally, I just don't think it's an either or. I don't think it's a trade-off that you have to make on cost versus effectiveness. And so, you know, there was some conversation around efficiency, and I kind of made the point that, you know, efficiency is not just about cost. And I think, you know, it's about eliminating waste, making sure that every dollar you spend actually delivers value over time and is effective. So, you know, you can use the example of cutting brand building. If you cut brand building today because it doesn't deliver short-term revenue on your P&L, and you cut brand building, your P&L a year from now will show that the efficiency that you thought you gained is evaporated, because I think then you'll realize, you know, that your effectiveness has gone down incredibly. So I think if you're efficient, you should also be effective by default. So that doesn't, you know, necessarily mean reducing quality or reducing the number of eyeballs. So my kind of counter to the great debate was like, I don't think it's a trade-off decision. I think it's an and. And there was conversations around, it was based on the premise that the head of Unilever was was saying that they were going to reduce budgets in TV and start putting more budgets towards creators. And, you know, like that attention has evolved. And so I think that's a smart decision to diversify and to really think about like where are people spending time? And to me, ultimately, that's what marketing will always be. It's about where consumers are, where you're trying to reach your customer and then evolving towards that attention, because attention is fragmented, but it's also fluid. And so even if you're watching TV, most people will have a phone in their hand at the same time, or on breaks especially, they'll break out their phone. And so it's really about capturing consumer attention and where those behaviors are going versus trying to make upfront smart marketing decisions on channel and trying to make a trade-off between cost versus outcome.
It's interesting what you say about the brand building efforts, where these are the type of messages that are repeated almost every session in our industry. It's something that you'd expect everyone in the industry to be brainwashed, and yet I've seen ad tech companies when maybe a marketing person moves on maybe they've had some cuts of the company and the marketer was somebody that was let go. And then there's often maybe somebody in a sales role takes over and they'll be like, yeah, we're not doing any events anymore. We're just going to, focus on our own sales efforts. I think often the belief that the company's success is based around what they do, which is probably something many of us are guilty of. But equally then you'll see within a year, people will start to ask, if that company is still around, if they still exist. And it's amazing. And often it's the companies that have built even larger brands in the minds of people, they have some brand equity there, but if they don't maintain it, it's even more noticeable when they're gone. I've seen this quite a few different times in the industry over the years, and it's amazing how people sometimes think brand building is just for these big companies and it's just for the larger players, but like every single company in this space has a brand or should have of some sort.
It's so hard to measure. That's the problem. I think that it turned into talking about the CFO and procurement versus marketing, and it's just I think that the danger sometimes, especially when it comes to TV and expectations that people have, is applying, just because you can measure digital or you can measure certain things doesn't mean that's the only measurement that matters. And so it just becomes harder to try to prove and show the receipts for what brand building does for a company. But you can absolutely see when you cease doing any kind of brand building, what happens. And, you find that in, I think there's a couple of examples in the, 2008, when we had a recession in the US, and also during COVID, where P&G amped up their advertising during those times where other companies were pulling back on their advertising, and what that did to their bottom line, and those time periods, I think, are a good case study for, what happens when you really invest in brand building and are not sure about the outcome, but it pays dividends for months and months. It's just not obvious. I think it's a time horizon problem of when you can attribute revenue to advertising activities, versus it doesn't work or it's not worth it, just because the measurability is different than it would be for something that was performance-based or, almost like real-time satisfaction in revenue increase.
I'm kind of hoping that AI is going to be able to solve this somehow. And there'll never be the direct attribution that people want. There's so many brands that I haven't bought yet. Maybe I can't afford that brand now, but I've got very positive associations, or maybe negative or non-existent associations. Mostly the people who've done their job on a strong brand, I'm carrying around this potential purchase in me for the future that it might have taken 20 or 30 years to build, but CFOs don't necessarily want those kind of time horizons. But I don't know, this thing of kowtowing to the CFO all the time. I mean, it's the nature of business, of course, but this thing of everything having to be quantified in every single instance, I get it. We can't just be going around with airy fairy hopes and dreams either. But the more rigorous we can get with it, I suppose, the better it'll get. So at the end of each podcast, I give each person 10 million to invest, and you can invest it in a company or a sector. You're not allowed to invest it in an index. So where would you invest it and why?
Is this real, Vinny? There's a check in the mail?
100%. You'll be a check in the post.
The most money I've ever received for a podcast.
Yeah.
This is really exciting.
It's our standard rate. Yeah. It's been a good year.
So exciting. I'd like to come back next week. Yeah. it'll just be me and you from now on.
Yeah.
you're like, please no. Okay. $10 million to invest in. This is actually a really, really hard question. I'm going to take kind of a broad view, and I'm going to say that I take preference towards companies who have been around for a long time, but have demonstrated adaptability and change. So if I think about, you know, one of my former, employers, Microsoft, you know, I worked there. I left in 2013, I guess. I started in 2007. And I remember my stock at the time. There's a lot of like employee stock purchase programs, and I had quite a bit of Microsoft stock. And I remember my coworkers at the time saying, oh my gosh, as soon as it hits 30, I'm selling all my stock. Like, but it needs to hit $30, which is not that much. And I, at the time, didn't know that much about stocks. And so I didn't sell anything. I just left it all there and thinking, I don't really know what this means. It was kind of funny money to me anyway. I never saw it. So, find it for it to sit off to the side. Microsoft has reinvented themselves, and you know, their stock price is definitely more than $30 today. That's for sure. And I love when a company who has been around for so long and has that heritage can put the right leadership in place and start to see the future and see around corners and try to really lean into what's happening to reinvent themselves over and over again. That to me is really exciting because you've got heritage and you have some level of legacy and innovation, but unafraid and willing to change is a really important part of staying relevant. And I'm really interested in what they're doing right now. They've got really interesting things going on with gaming and with AI and opportunities with their ads business, but also their core business is humming. And so I think their leadership that's in place, the people I know who've worked there for a long time are super excited about what they're doing right now, which is really, really cool to see. And the other company that comes to mind like this is Netflix, which, you know, I was an early subscriber to Netflix. I used to get the DVDs at home. They have reinvented themselves and stayed relevant. And I think that's amazing. And I think they're going to continue to figure out what's next in streaming and where they need to be positioned next in order to continue to thrive. So I think that's interesting. And you said I can't invest in index, but index is one of those companies to me too, where we've been around for over 20 years, started out as an ad network, moved to RTB, like we're continuing to evolve and we are not shy of taking risks and trying to you know, skate where the puck is. Because we're Canadian, I'll use that analogy.
Yeah, the adaptability thing. Yeah, just going back to Microsoft, I shouldn't take it too quickly away from Index. Index is most certainly one of those companies that, there were many, even, you know, far bigger companies that were in that network business pre-programmatic that are no longer with us. And now Index is here thriving and has managed to, you know, move to the next new thing each and every time and made good bets, you know.
Yeah. I can say that from as a third party in a way, because I joined Index, you know, only 5 years ago, but I do tell Andrew, like, I think it's the coolest thing really that, you know, you start a company and you are that identity for years and years. Casale Media, it used to be called Casale Media, as an ad network. And to see the writing on the wall and say, oh my gosh, the IO business is going to die. and real-time bidding is the future. And this is and to repivot and build brand new technology and business models and operating structures, and not being too precious about the past and just moving forward, I think is a really interesting move. And the fact that they were able to do it, that they didn't die without outside investment, is to me a testament and core to who Index is as a culture and as a company. It's a company I'd place my bet on, to be honest. And I feel the way about these other big behemoth companies who have done it as well. But it takes a lot to recognize when things are moving beyond your capabilities, and you know, you can either sell, you can shut it down, you can die out slowly, or you can take your destiny into your own hands and foresee where the market is headed. And that's, I think, a really unique attribute for companies, especially a small independent company.
It sounds so easy, like change to, you know, just do the new thing. But you know, if you look at the innovator's dilemma and the, you know, what companies are confronted with when they've got legacy businesses, and to be able to sacrifice the old to move on to the new and maybe stop doing things that have been your bread and butter for as long as you can remember, it's really tough, you know. By no means easy to do. Microsoft as well, yes, it's an incredible one that, yeah, I would not have guessed that Microsoft would reinvent itself in quite the way that they have, and to become, you know, a company with so many really cool, innovative things going on.
Cool. And you know, the thing that I think actually helps, and this kind of goes back a little bit to the marketing question for me about Index, but the thing that helps, I think, these companies through is a strong corporate company identity. If you know who you are as a company and you stick to that because it's principle-based, it's values-based, it becomes easier to make those pivots because it's true to who you are, if that makes sense. And it's those things are unwavering. Values are unwavering. Principles are unwavering. And if the decisions that you make are guided by values and principles and a core identity, it's hard to make the wrong decision in that instance, because it's supported by something that's unwavering and very true and core to who we are. So I think when you start to see, and this kind of plays back to other things that we've talked about on this podcast, but when you start to see maybe where the desperation comes in, or you know, quick reactions to something that's happening externally, it's typically like where is the North Star? You know, how do you return to center and really take stock of who you are as a company, what your vision for that company is, and the people that work with your company, to make better decisions about how you're going to move forward, that's guided with a really strong backbone. And that's where I feel kind of fortunate, I think, in Index for having that constant of value.
Well, we're doing a session on values in the new year at Video Week, and I'm probably going to transcribe everything you said there, use it as my own words, and
you should. There's no TM associated, because I'm getting my $10 million check, Vinny. So
it is, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so
you won't be in the industry anymore anyway.
Yeah. Yay me.
Okay, Laurie, that was a lot of fun and super interesting. Thanks so much for taking the time, and yeah, hope to have you back sometime.
All right, thanks for having me, Vinny.